All right, I think we're ready to go here. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers. This is a special Patreon episode, so we're going to play a little fast and loose with the rules here today. I've actually expelled Taylor from the government of Beyond the Breakers for this episode, so we have established the Provisional People's Republic of Beyond the Breakers. And by we, I do mean that we have a special guest here today, joined here by Katie. Katie, say hi to everyone.
Hey everyone.
All right, and Katie, for anyone not in the know, Katie is, to quote a great Kazakh ambassador, my wife.
His wife.
So we're here today. We are going to do something different. We are technically talking about a shipwreck. That is part of the story, but more specifically, we are talking about a film. We like to do little movie corner here for some of our Patreon episodes, and that's what we have here today. I will just first of all thank Katie for joining me on this. Katie is a longtime listener, probably technically our oldest fan,
Yeah,
maybe I would
oldest
say.
and biggest fan, definitely.
So yeah, we have a film that we want to talk about here. Gotta think of a name for these movie episodes, but we'll get to that later. Today we're talking about probably what I would say is the premier classic of New England sword fishing cinema, I would say. It's pretty much tops in the genre. Pretty much untouchable. We're talking, of course, about The Perfect Storm from the year 2000. So, Katie, had you seen this movie before we watched it last night?
I have not. At least I don't think so.
Yeah, did you enjoy it?
It was a solid movie.
Solid is a good word for this
Yeah,
movie, I would
solid
say.
movie.
Yeah, it was a movie I hadn't seen in a long time. Taylor and I had watched it when it came out in theaters. I believe we were in North Carolina visiting our grandparents, and we went to see it in theater with our granddad. So we watched it then. It struck me as a very it was a very grown-up movie for my age at the time. But I remember, enjoying it, I think. I would say on second watch, it really holds up mainly due to its pretty star-studded cast. We've got George Clooney. We've got Mark Wahlberg, kind of a young Mark Wahlberg, for just fresh out of the Funky Bunch, I think. We've got John C. Reilly, who I think many people, probably roughly our age, maybe don't appreciate as much as a serious
It
actor.
was so weird. It was so weird seeing him be serious. I kept thinking he was gonna make a fart joke or something, and it was just and nothing, straight
Yeah,
face.
you expect him to break into something comedic, and it just never happens. And yeah, like you see that in like Road to Perdition that he's in, even in like Days of Thunder, where he plays kind of a similar character to his Ricky Bobby character. Yeah, so seeing John C. Reilly in this was good. William Fichtner, who maybe the name doesn't ring a bell with everyone, but
Nothing.
the face definitely would. If you Google William Fichtner, you will know this actor. He's in tons of movies, and TV shows, actually. Some people may know him as as Allison Janney's boyfriend in the show Mom.
That's where I know him
Yeah,
from.
that's where many people probably
That's
now know him from.
oh. Oh, okay.
Yeah, he just kind of plays a lot of he's rarely the lead character in anything. He plays really solid supporting characters though. Diane Lane is in it.
Sorry, I can't get over the mom thing. That just blew my mind.
Oh yeah, see that's why I saved it. That's why I saved it for the recording. I didn't want to waste that. I want to empty the chamber too early there. We've got Michael McDonald here. He plays the weatherman who talks about this quote unquote perfect storm. Michael McDonald, again, maybe the name doesn't ring a bell, but Shooter McGavin definitely does. We also do have Bob Gunton, who plays the warden in Shawshank Redemption. So we really do have a cast of characters, and every time someone new comes on the screen, you say, oh, I know that person. I know that person. Really is a great movie from a casting perspective. But in addition to the cast itself, it's directed by Wolfgang Petersen. And going into this rewatch, I really didn't know that this was a director's name I should know. I'm not a huge movie guy. But he did direct the movie Das Boot, which we probably will cover on a bonus episode sometime. He directed Air Force One, Troy, the remake of Poseidon, and The Neverending Story. That one strikes me as kind of an outlier.
Yeah, which one does it belong?
Yeah, one of these things is definitely not like the others. So, for those unfamiliar, the movie tells the story of the Andrea Gale, a sword fishing boat that sailed out of Gloucester, Massachusetts from 1978 to 1991. It's based on a book by Sebastian Junger, which I had started a little bit ago, and actually just finished this morning, about 2 hours ago. It's a very good read. He's a very good writer. He weaves a very interesting narrative. But before we jump into discussing the movie, I have prepared a pop quiz for Katie.
Oh,
To establish some baseline knowledge about some of the topics involved. This is a legit pop quiz. She does not know the answers.
No clue. I kind of have a little bit of quiz anxiety right now.
But we'll start easy. I'm a teacher. I like to start students out with easy questions and ease them into the harder ones. So, question one. Why is it called a swordfish?
Has a sword on its forehead.
There we go. Yeah, it's got a sword right on it. Just right on its face.
Right on its face.
But how much does the average swordfish weigh?
Oh, gosh. Well, it took about, four of those guys to haul one up with a hook. They're pretty strong guys. I don't know, 400 to 500 pounds. Is that ridiculous?
That's exactly what I've written on my notes here.
Really?
400 to 500 pounds.
No way!
Yes.
I swear I didn't even see
good guess.
It. Nice. Maybe I should be a fisherman.
Maybe.
Yeah.
They seem to make good but possibly spotty money, yeah. So we'll look into that. How many Oscars has George Clooney won?
Oh. It's probably one of two numbers, something ridiculous like one, because, he should have won a lot, or something ridiculous like 40.
Has anyone won 40 Oscars?
Probably not. I'm going to say between 1 and 20. No, realistically, let's say 8.
Okay. You're close. He's been nominated 8 times.
Oh.
Okay. He has, in fact, won 2 of them.
Really? So I was close with 1.
And they are not for movies that I expected.
Huh.
He's been in a ton of movies, a ton of big movies. These are not movies that I expected.
I'm kind of surprised. Huh.
He won one of them for Syriana. I believe his best supporting actor. And he won one for co-directing Argo.
Oh.
So those are not the two I would have guessed, I guess, initially.
Oh, okay.
All right. In 1988, Mark Wahlberg was charged with attempted murder and then convicted of felony assault after a racially motivated attack on a Vietnamese-American man who had previously served in the South Vietnamese Army alongside our brave U.S. troops. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison. How much of this time did he actually serve?
Oh, man. That's terrible. I'm going to guess 4 months.
You are overestimating.
Oh, my gosh. Did he serve none of it?
He served 45 days. So, what, about a month and a half?
Wow.
All right.
Wow.
My last question here. How many stars out of 5 did Roger Ebert give The Perfect Storm?
I'm wondering if it goes with, the average ratings I saw for it. I don't know. So out of 5, I'm going to say, do they do halves?
Yes, you could do halves.
Let's give it a 3.
Very, very close. Roger Ebert gave it a 3.5 stars.
Okay, I was going to do 3.5.
His review for this movie is actually very interesting. He kind of goes into how this movie is one where it doesn't really have deep, well-developed characters, but you don't need them. That's not the story.
No.
The characters themselves, in the context of this, 2-hour film, are not what you need. It really is a bigger picture of this culture and this particular event.
Right, and the characters are kind of representing all of these Gloucester fishermen over the years, so it's kind of like you kind of have to wrap all of these fishermen into them. And,
Yeah, that's a good point, is how a lot of these sort of anecdotes and stories and things that you sort of hear about this trade of these sword fishermen and fishermen in general in this area are sort of amalgamated into these, 6 characters on this boat.
Right.
So they do kind of come across as not the most developed, but they kind of cover all of the bases that you need.
They're good representation, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's do a quick plot rundown here. So we have an opening scene in this film. It kind of starts with like a scary, dreamy storm sequence, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like a kind of like a nightmare almost.
Yeah.
But then we see the our main ship, the Andrea Gale, captained by George Clooney's character. He is playing Captain Billy Tyne of the Andrea Gale. They come into port. They unload their haul, kind of along with their sister ship, the Hannah Bowden. They unload their haul, and the owner, Bob Brown, played by Michael Ironsides, is there on the deck, or not on the deck, on the dock, rather. He is, let's say, unimpressed with George Clooney's catch.
Yeah.
This is kind of an interesting first characterization of Bob Brown, the owner of the vessel. In the book, you get a sense that he is, you know, a bit aloof from the human side of things, but not necessarily antagonistic. In the movie, they kind of set up this drama right away that, you know, it's sort of fisherman versus owner. He comes off as kind of greedy and sort of not understanding the plight of the men. That doesn't seem to be historically accurate based on the research that Sebastian Junger did, but it's a movie. They need drama. It's part of the game, I guess. They're in this bar called the Crow's Nest. I really liked how the movie represented the Crow's Nest based on the book representation.
Yeah.
It was almost exactly
a cool place to hang out.
Almost exactly what I expected.
Yeah.
I want to be just a retired old sea captain who just sits in a bar and drinks all day. I don't want to do the first part. I don't want to actually be a sea captain. I just want the retirement part. And the hat. He has a cool hat. So in the movie, this is the first really, really big divergence. In the movie, they play it out that because they had this very, very low haul, Billy Tyne, George Clooney, is makes this sort of snap decision to make one last run. It's sort of the end of the season. There's really not enough time to do this, but he says, you know, we have to do this. We have to go big or go home, basically. So he's going to take his boat out for one last trip.
Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. We know from the show that's probably not a good thing. You never want to...
No.
When it's man versus the ocean almost always wins. Don't challenge the open sea, basically. We have extra drama. I'm developing that Boston already. Sully, William Fichtner, and Murph, who's played by John C. Reilly, they have there's a very, very developed drama between them. In the movie, that doesn't really exist that much in the book.
Definitely very kind of artificial drama.
Yeah, it's very... It almost seems cliched, but it almost also seems like for a more modern type of movie, that maybe that was one of the trendsetters, you know, yeah. Movies of the
2000s. Yeah. Oh, yes, it was a very movie of the 2000s.
This is very much a 2000s 90s, movie.
Yeah,
And... So that is talked about in the book, the drama among the crew, but really only in the general context of this would happen to any group of people stuck together on a boat for three months at a time.
With only three movies.
In the movie, they only have like three VHS tapes, but in the book, it points out that they had like a tote bin of them, I believe. Regardless, that's probably not going to keep you sane if you're losing it out at sea. Having that copy of Heat on VHS is not gonna solve your problems. So they have only minor success at first. There's kind of an opening sequence of them pulling swordfish on board, kind of to establish what this process looks like. You can see them pulling the fish out of the water. You see them using all the hooks and stuff they have to use to get these fish on board. You see how they have to decapitate the swordfish pretty quickly, because obviously you have this big heavy fish with a big sword on its face flailing around on deck.
Yeah, not good.
You kind of see the process of how they process and pack them in the hold in ice. It just kind of to establish the trade and what that looks like.
It was fascinating.
It was kind of cool.
Interesting. I had no idea they like packed ice inside the fish, which is brilliant because mm-hmm. you know, saves space, keeps it cold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another job to consider, yeah, being a fish packer.
Yeah.
So they have that, and then they kind of hit a drought. Everyone starts getting upset, kind of saying they should go back home. But Captain Billy Tyne, he says no. He says, we're going to go further east. We're going out to the Flemish Cap. to sort of, you know, get this bigger possible haul of fish.
That's where the good stuff is.
Oh, yeah. I guess. John C. Reilly's character makes a comment like, why don't we just steam all the way to Portugal if we're going that far? It's really not that far off the mainland of North America, Flemish Cap, but they sort of play it up a little bit more in the movie than it is in the book. There's a really cool scene involving a Mako shark, where they pull a shark on board.
Yeah.
Well, in the book, it's specifically that it's a Mako shark, that this was a big deal. In the movie, I'm not great at identifying sharks.
Yeah.
Probably like I was eight, like maybe I would have been able to say, like, yes, for sure, that's a Mako or that's a black tip shark or whatever. Now I have no idea. It just is a shark. That was actually interesting to learn. Younger in his book points out that Mako sharks eat basically the same stuff that swordfish eat. So if you're fishing for swordfish, that's a very, very good chance of catching a Mako shark. Mark Wahlberg's character, Bobby, gets bitten by the shark. His foot is like in its mouth, and they have to use a shotgun to like blast it off, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Let's see. Eventually they start catching again. Murph, at one point, he actually gets hooked on one of the hooks that's going overboard, and it drags him over. And actually, I think, Katie, I think you called this, you called this, like, 15 minutes into the movie. The first time that we see Sully and Murph have an argument, I think you called this. But, of course, when Murph gets dragged overboard, the first person to notice and dive in after him is
Sully,
of course.
Of course.
So Sully goes in and saves him. They have sort of a gruff detente afterwards, where they're probably still not friends, but there's a grudging acknowledgement that, hey, this person saved my life. I can stop being a jerk to him.
Yeah.
So now Sully and Murph are able to work together.
How easy that is. Just go overboard. Your enemy will go save you. Everything's okay.
Yeah, just get a fishing hook through your hand and dragged over into the Atlantic Ocean. That's another example. We talked about earlier sort of condensing these anecdotes and these stories together to tell a larger story about this culture of sword fishing. And that's exactly what this is. That specific Mako shark attack didn't necessarily happen on this trip, but it's sort of revisiting an older anecdote that I believe happened to Murph, is the one who had actually been attacked by a shark on deck of his ship. Again, in the movie, that happens to Bobby Shatford, Mark Wahlberg's character. Where else? There's a parallel plot line, actually. Of a sailboat that in the movie is called the Mistral. It's the Satori in the book and the real world. And the rescue that's undertaken by, in my notes, I've written the Coast Guard. I think it was technically the Air National Guard who did some of that. Mm-hmm. And part of it was done by the Coast Guard. So that's an interesting side element to it. Yeah. It's ridiculous. With all these sort of scenes where you have these massive container ships and you have these sword fishing boats that are kind of built for heavy weather, and then it just cuts to this sailboat.
Yeah,
that's like
a little sailboat just tottering out on the sea.
Yeah, and it's just getting destroyed by these waves, this wind. So it's kind of a recurring plot that they keep cutting back to. It kind of just adds a little bit of extra drama to it.
Yeah. More of a human element.
Yeah.
They had their own little drama going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You also have the issues between the two female crew members and the male captain, where the captain seems to be sort of out of sorts. There are accusations in the real story that he was drinking, and that's why he was not making good decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But that I don't think that ever came up in the movie.
No, I don't think so.
That sailboat eventually ended up... the two female crew members issued an SOS call or a Mayday call without the captain's permission, and that brought in the rescue people. And the captain attempted to wave them off, but the Coast Guard declared it a, I think they call it a manifestly unsafe voyage. where it's basically a forced evacuation of like, we will drag you off this if we have to. But anyway, back to the Andrea Gale. The weather gets increasingly worse as these three different weather systems are converging. One of them is Hurricane Grace and two other weather systems coming like out of Canada. With this increasingly bad weather, Andrea Gale loses her windows, which is a huge problem, obviously, and eventually her antenna. So there's a scene where the antenna breaks off and Bobby Shatford, Mark Wahlberg, has to sort of climb up and try to reattach it, but that is unsuccessful. This is the point in both the book and the movie where the plot necessarily has to diverge from any sort of true narrative, because we have literally no idea what happens after this point. That's basically the last that is heard of the ship on the radio a little bit before that. So that radio silence could indicate that that's when the ship went down, or that's just when they lost communication. So from this, there's a lot more narrative license for the both the writer and the filmmaker.
That's where the Hollywood magic comes.
It really is, and there's a lot of it in this final 20 minutes of this movie are pretty much like nonstop, just like wind and wave action.
Very stressful.
It is. Especially because I think the movie's like, 15 to 20 minutes too long.
Yeah.
I'd
agree with that.
A lot of it is just sort of, it's not empty action, but it's close.
Yeah. I feel like the come down could have happened sooner because, that was intense for a very long time.
Right. So the ship ends up, I think pitch poling is the term, where it rides up the front of a wave, but it's a wave that's too big for it to surmount, basically. And it ends up sliding back down the face of it and going under stern first. There's a lot of math, actually, that goes into like whether a ship can survive a given wave or not. Basically, if a wave is more than the length of a ship, it basically increases the chance that this is going to happen. And that's what happens in the film. The ship goes under, it capsizes. We see sort of the last moments of the crew. You have kind of what you'd expect in this moment from a Hollywood movie. Sort of little pairs or groups of men. The water's slowly rising, and it's pretty inevitable what's going to happen. There's a final scene with the captain, Billy Tyne, and Bobby Shatford, where they kind of do a fake out a little bit.
Yeah.
You kind of think they're just accepting their fate. They're going to go under. But then all of a sudden, George Clooney says, like, let's get out of here.
Yeah, they get, like, a last burst of, like, optimism, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe there's a chance.
And here's the ultimate fake-out. So they're going out. Bobby, Mark Wahlberg, he swims out. He's going to the surface. And sneaky devil, George Clooney, he sort of watches him go. And then you see him just kind of recede back into the boat. He has made the decision to go down with his ship.
It was kind of interesting in that final scene. I just kind of had a flashback thoughts of all of the podcasts you guys have done, episodes, and all of the ships. And, like, it kind of gave a visual of all of these people that have drowned on these ships. It was just kind of like, I don't know, I just thought about all of the people you guys have told the stories of.
That really is an interesting thing. Even here where we, you know, one of the goals is to tell more individual stories. You really can't cover all of them. And it's very hard to grasp the idea that, like, what's depicted in the film, and obviously that's a dramatization of it, but still, this whole aspect of going down with the ship and those final desperate moments, that's happening to each individual person who has died on these ships that we've talked about.
Yeah, anyone that didn't die right away from explosion or whatever, this is all how they went. They all had these similar final moments.
Yeah.
It was very poignant.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So we kind of see the last of them at sea is Mark Wahlberg all alone, and you just have these absolutely massive waves, and you know one big one finally comes and just kind of swallows him up. And then it sort of cuts to a memorial service in Gloucester, Massachusetts, where you see the big wall with all the names of people who have been lost at sea out of Gloucester. So yeah, overall, I mean, good movie. I'm glad we rewatched it, for sure. definitely having done the podcast, I went into it, both the book and the movie, with a different eye for what's happening, even just basic things like terminology and why certain things are being done than I would have before. So it was really an interesting exercise in, analysis. It was fun. Some other differences we'll talk about from the sort of quote-unquote real story from the book and the film. One of them is about the decision to make the return trip. So in the movie, this storm develops behind them, and it's sort of already fully grown, and they have to make a decision. Do we try to run this storm and get home in time to save our catch? Because they'll spoil in the hold if they don't.
Because their ice machine broke.
Right.
Yeah, that was a big part of it.
Yes, like they have a malfunctioning ice machine. All these fish they just spent all this time catching are not going to survive's the wrong word because they're already dead. They're not going to last until they get back if they wait wait out this storm before returning. So they have to make a conscious decision of trying to run through this storm. That's not actually what happened. So in fact, they were already, I believe it was 3 days into their return journey when these storms sort of all coalesced around them.
In the book.
In the book, yes. In the kind of what really happened to this vessel. One of the sort of accusations or criticisms of the movie is that it does make the crew, and specifically Billy Tyne, look more reckless than they probably actually were being.
Yeah.
The idea of trying to run this storm for the sake of their catch. Would that have been something they would have decided to do? Quite possibly. You know, we see that in a lot of our stories of you've got to weigh the safety versus getting your job done.
Right.
But that's not what happened here. It was essentially a case of being in the worst possible spot when this happened. This wasn't like El Faro, where you had, you know, potential access to all of the information you needed and could have avoided it. Mm-hmm. This was, they're already here, and these three weather systems converge on them.
Yeah, it was like a victim of, they were victims of just crazy circumstances.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that was even mentioned in the reports is that they did lose communication, and obviously that's never a good thing. Even had they been able to communicate, just given where they were in the storm, probably would have precluded any sort of rescue attempt. Because they were in about as bad of conditions as you can possibly imagine. Any rescue attempt was probably out of the question anyway.
Right.
Another one, like I kind of mentioned, is Bob Brown, the owner. There's a scene towards the end when people are starting to realize that this ship is missing and it's probably not coming back. Bob Brown walks into the bar and everyone kind of has this negative reaction to him being there. Actually, in the real story, that was his wife who went in there, not him. Because, as it points out in the book, he kind of had stuff to be doing. He had multiple ships out in this, and he was making pretty constant phone calls trying to get in touch with these captains. He really was essentially doing his job at the time, trying to see where his people were. Bob Brown doesn't seem like a great guy, necessarily. I mean, he doesn't necessarily seem like a dude you'd hang out with and have a good time with, but he doesn't necessarily all seem evil.
Yeah.
He's portrayed in the movie. I think the movie kind of does him a disservice. I don't know. I don't know enough about it to really opine. I think they kind of do him dirty in the movie a little bit.
Yeah.
Not a lot, but a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, they like exaggerate things.
Mm-hmm. But hey, that's movies, I guess. rescue attempts is another kind of difference between the book and the movie. The rescue attempts, again, are kind of condensed into just two of them. There were a bunch of ships out in this big storm. The Halloween Gale, they call it. But there were a lot of ships out in this. Some of the rescue elements are actually taken from it was actually a single occupant sailboat. It was a Japanese sailor who was out in a sailboat all alone who required a rescue. So that kind of added part of the rescue elements to this movie. They sort of drew from that. There was that sailboat, the Satori, that required rescue. So you have multiple ships out in this. Like any of these big storms, they're going to catch more than just one boat. So that was kind of another thing that was sort of conflated and trimmed down to be more filmable. But those are some of the coolest sequences in it, is watching the rescue divers going in, attempting to rescue these people. One of the elements in the movie that adds some drama, they attempt to drop down a rescue basket to the sailboat, and it gets wrapped around the mast, and it almost drags the helicopter under. That didn't happen for specifically that reason. That's why they don't do that. That's why they don't drop those baskets in that situation.
Oh.
That was one of the elements in the book that I actually just finished this morning. But anyway, always want to add more drama to the movie.
Yep.
So, that's sort of the rundown of the plot. That covers a lot of the big things we wanted to cover. There is one final thing that I think will make Katie very, very happy when I read this. Okay. So there was a thing, Katie, you're familiar with the Razzies, right?
Oh, yeah. That's
so,
the opposite of the Oscars and stuff, right?
Talking about something similar, I don't know if there's like an organization actually behind the Razzies or if it's just some people on the internet who do that.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works. But anyway, there was a similar set of awards called the Stinkers that were awarded from 1978 to 2006. This film was awarded a stinker.
Really?
I'm going to give you a multiple choice question.
Okay.
On what this was awarded a stinker for.
Okay.
Think back to some of the things that you commented on as we were watching the movie. So, The Perfect Storm won a stinker award. I believe this was probably in 2000, the year it came out. Was it for most annoying fake accent, worst on-screen hairstyle, least special effects, or most intrusive musical score?
Oh my god, please, the musical score. Oh, it was horrible.
Yes, tell us about the musical score.
It was like the same upswelling music every single time, and it was very spoilery because something like dramatic would be happening, and all of a sudden this like music comes up in the middle of this drama, and it's just that has this very positive, uplifting like sound and tone to it, so you know that everything's gonna be okay. Like, they're gonna get the dude out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
Things are gonna be okay. It was just the same music over and over and over again, and it was so corny, and it just, every time I was like, here it comes again.
And I think you described it as, it was like the credit music was rolling like every 20 minutes.
And it started within the first couple of minutes.
Every time something happened, like,
movie.
It was the same, like you said, swelling music that...
Triumphant, like...
It sort of gave away the, like, hey, at least in this particular thing, like, stuff's gonna be fine.
Yes.
All
throughout the movie, it was terrible. Please tell me that's the answer.
Intrusive, yes. Most intrusive musical score.
Okay.
Yeah, indeed.
It's terrible. Yeah, because the CGI wasn't too bad. I was actually really impressed, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Was CGI a thing then?
I assume so. Actually, yeah, I don't. I assume
whenever
that's
they
what
had
they
use
did
to make things look realistic. I was kind of impressed.
I thought the swordfish on the boat looked better than the swordfish in the water. I thought that the swordfish in the water looked a little bit like mechanical,
mechanical thrashing kind of.
But
once
they were on deck, I thought they looked a little bit better.
Yeah.
The Mako shark scene seemed decent. They've come a ways since Jaws. Even at that point.
Yes.
I mean, overall, it was a good movie. It was a good
solid.
Good movie about a boat. Good movie about a shipwreck. Since I guess it's our responsibility on this show to talk about the actual wreck itself. Andrea Gale was never recovered. It's a relatively small boat in a pretty big ocean. Some debris was recovered from it. Various bits of gear from the deck and things like that. Overall, I mean, it is a tragic story. In that storm, obviously, the Andrea Gale went down. I believe one of the rescue swimmers was also lost. Trying to rescue one of the vessels, not the Andrea Gale. but one of those others we talked about. So yeah, overall, I mean, that's what we did last night. It was a good use of time, I thought, to rewatch that. Yeah. Kind of long for my tastes for movies, but this was it kept me entertained, I think.
Yeah, it didn't feel like it was extra long.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, that's going to be a wrap, I think, for our bonus episode. I'll probably do another movie next month at some point, regardless of whether that's maybe a more realistic or true story like this one was, or something a little bit more out there like Poseidon, maybe even something spooky like Ghost Ship. Who knows what we're going to do. But again, if you listen to this one, thank you for your support. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate interacting with everyone. We definitely appreciate reviews and things on places like iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And yeah, we're excited to get this one out so you guys can listen to it. So until next week, take care, everyone.